to give way before the hard fact that I was quite unknown, and therefore did not even have the first prerequisite necessary for effective action. Later on, I shall explain the reasons why I could not decide to join any of the parties then in existence. As the new Soviet revolution began to run its course in Munich, my first activities drew upon me the ill will of the Central Council. In the early morning of April the 27th, 1919, I was to have been arrested, but the three fellows who came to arrest me did not have the courage to face my rifle, and withdrew just as they had arrived. A few days after the liberation of Munich, I was ordered to appear before the Inquiry Commission, which had been set up in the 2nd Infantry Regiment for the purpose of watching revolutionary activities. That was my first incursion into the more or less political field. After another few weeks, I received orders to attend a course of lectures which were being given to members of the army. This course was meant to inculcate certain fundamental principles on which the soldier could base his political ideas. For me, the advantage of this organization was that it gave me a chance of meeting fellow soldiers who were of the same way of thinking, and with whom I could discuss the actual situation. We were all more or less firmly convinced that Germany could not be saved from imminent disaster by those who had participated in the November treachery, that is to say, the Centre and the Social Democrats, and also that the so-called bourgeois national group could not make good the damage that had been done, even if they had the best intentions. They lacked a number of requisites, without which such a task could never be successfully undertaken. The years that followed have justified the opinions which we held at that time. In our small circle, we discussed the project of forming a new party. The leading ideas which we then proposed were the same as those which were carried into effect afterwards, when the German Labour Party was founded. The name of the new movement which was to be founded should be such that, of itself, it would appeal to the mass of the people, for all our efforts would turn out vain and useless if this condition were lacking. And that was the reason why we chose the name Social Revolutionary Party, particularly because the social principles of our new organization were indeed revolutionary. But there was also a more fundamental reason. The attention which I had given to economic problems during my earlier years was more or less confined to considerations arising directly out of the social problem. Subsequently, this outlook broadened as I came to study the German policy of the Triple Alliance. This policy was very largely the result of an erroneous valuation of the economic situation, together with a confused notion as to the basis on which the future subsistence of the German people could be guaranteed. All these ideas were based on the principle that capital is exclusively the product of labour, and that, just like labour, it was subject to all the factors which can hinder or promote human activity. Hence, from the national standpoint, the significance of capital depended on the greatness and freedom and power of the state, that is to say, of the nation, and that it is this dependence alone which leads capital to promote the interests of the state and the nation from the instinct of self-preservation and for the sake of its own development. On such principles, the attitude of the state towards capital would be comparatively simple and clear. Its only object would be to make sure that capital remained subservient to the state and did not allocate to itself the right to dominate national interests. Thus, it could confine its activities within the two following limits. On the one side, to assure a vital and independent system of national economy, and on the other, to safeguard the social rights of the workers. Previously, I did not recognise with adequate clearness the difference between capital, which is purely the product of creative labour, and the existence and nature of capital, which is exclusively the result of financial speculation. Here, I needed an impulse to set my mind thinking in this direction, but that impulse had hitherto been lacking. The requisite impulse now came from one of the men who delivered lectures in the course I have already mentioned. This was Gottfried Feder. For the first time in my life, I heard a discussion which dealt with the principles of stock exchange capital and capital which was used for loan activities. After hearing the first lecture delivered by Feder, the idea immediately came into my head that I had now found a way to one of the most essential prerequisites for the founding of a new party. To my mind, Feder's merit consisted in the ruthless and trenchant way in which he described the double character of the capital engaged in stock exchange and loan transaction, laying bare the fact that this capital is ever and always dependent on the payment of interest. In fundamental questions, his statements were so full of common sense that those who criticised him did not deny that, au fond, his ideas were sound, but they doubted whether it be possible to put these ideas into practice. To me, this seemed the strongest point in Feder's teaching, though others considered it a weak point. It is not the business of him who lays down a theoretical program to explain the various ways in which something can be put into practice. His task is to deal with the problem as such, and therefore he has to look to the end rather than the means. The important question is whether an idea is fundamentally right or not. The question of whether or not it may be difficult to carry it out in practice is quite another matter. When a man whose task it is to lay down the principles of a program or policy begins to busy himself with the questions as to whether it is expedient and practical, instead of confining himself to the statement of the absolute truth, his work will cease to be a guiding star to those who are looking about for light and leading, and will become merely a recipe for everyday life. The man who lays down the program of a movement must consider only the goal. It is for the political leader to point out the way in which that goal may be reached. The thought of the former will, therefore, be determined by those truths that are everlasting, whereas the activity of the latter must always be guided by taking practical account of the circumstances under which those truths have to be carried into effect. The greatness of the one will depend on the absolute truth of his idea, considered in the abstract, whereas that of the other will depend on whether or not he correctly judges the given realities and how they may be utilised under the guidance of the truths established by the former. The test of greatness, as applied to a political leader, is the success of his plans and his enterprises, which means his ability to reach the goal for which he sets out. Whereas the final goal set up by the political philosopher can never be reached. For human thought may grasp truths and picture ends which it sees like clear crystal, though such ends can never be completely fulfilled, because human nature is weak and imperfect. The more an idea is correct in the abstract, and therefore all the more powerful, the smaller is the possibility of putting it into practice, at least as far as this latter depends on human beings. The significance of a political philosopher does not depend on the practical success of the plans he lays down, but rather on their absolute truth and the influence they exert on the progress of mankind. If it were otherwise, the founders of religions could not be considered as the greatest men who have ever lived, because their moral aims will never be completely or even approximately carried out in practice. Even that religion which is called the religion of love is really no more than a faint reflex of the will of its sublime founder. But its significance lies in the orientation which it endeavoured to give to human civilization and human virtue and morals. This very wide difference between the functions of a political philosopher and a practical political leader is the reason why the qualifications necessary for both functions are scarcely ever found associated in the same person. This applies especially to the so-called successful politician of the smaller kind, whose activity is indeed hardly more than practicing the art of doing the possible, as Bismarck modestly defined the art of politics in general. If such a politician resolutely avoids great ideas, his success will be all the easier to attain. It will be attained more expeditely, and frequently will be more tangible. By reason of this very fact, however, such success is doomed to futility, and sometimes does not even survive the death of its author. Generally speaking, the work of politicians is without significance for the following generation, because their temporary success was based on the expediency of avoiding all really great decisive problems and ideas which would be valid also for future generations.
File 45.
To pursue ideals which will still be of value and significance for the future is generally not a very profitable undertaking, and he who follows such a course is only very rarely understood by the masses of the people, who find beer and milk a more persuasive index of political values than far-sighted plans for the future, the realization of which can only take place later on, and the advantages of which can be reaped only by posterity. Because of a certain vanity, which is always one of the blood relations of unintelligence, the general run of politicians will always eschew those schemes for the future which are really difficult to put into practice, and they will practice this avoidance so that they may not lose the immediate favour of the mob. The importance and success of such politicians belong exclusively to the present and will be of no consequence for the future. But that does not worry small-minded people. They are quite content with momentary results. The position of the constructive political philosopher is quite different. The importance of his work must always be judged from the standpoint of the future, and he is frequently described by the word Weltfremd, or dreamer. While the ability of the politician consists in mastering the art of the possible, the founder of a political system belongs to those who are said to please the gods only because they wish for and demand the impossible. They will always have to renounce contemporary fame, but if their ideas be immortal, posterity will grant them its acknowledgement. Within long spans of human progress, it may occasionally happen that the practical politician and political philosopher are one. The more intimate this union is, the greater will be the obstacles which the activity of the politician will have to encounter. Such a man does not labour for the purpose of satisfying demands that are obvious to every Philistine, but he reaches out towards ends which can be understood only by the few. His life is torn asunder by hatred and love. The protest of his contemporaries, who do not understand the man, is in conflict with the recognition of posterity, for whom he also works. For the greater the work which a man does for the future, the less will he be appreciated by his contemporaries. His struggle will accordingly be all the more severe, and his success all the rarer. When, in the course of centuries, such a man appears who is blessed with success, then, towards the end of his days, he may have a faint prevision of his future fame. But such great men are only the marathon runners of history. The laurels of contemporary fame are only for the brow of the dying hero. The great protagonists are those who fight for their ideas and ideals despite the fact that they receive no recognition at the hands of their contemporaries. They are the men whose memories will be enshrined in the hearts of the future generations. It seems, then, as if each individual felt it his duty to make retroactive atonement for the wrong which great men have suffered at the hands of their contemporaries. Their lives and their work are then studied with touching and grateful admiration. Especially in dark days of distress, such men have the power of healing broken hearts and elevating the despairing spirit of a people. To this group belong not only the genuinely great statesmen, but all the great reformers as well. Beside Frederick the Great, we have such men as Martin Luther and Richard Wagner. When I heard Gottfried Feder's first lecture on the abolition of the interest servitude, I understood immediately that here was a truth of transcendental importance for the future of the German people. The absolute separation of stock exchange capital from the economic life of the nation would make it possible to oppose the process of internationalization in German business without at the same time attacking capital as such, for to do this would jeopardize the foundations of our national independence. I clearly saw what was developing in Germany, and I realized then that the stiffest fight we would have to wage would not be against the enemy nations, but against international capital. In Feder's speech, I found an effective rallying cry for our coming struggle. Here, again, later events proved how correct was the impression we then had. The fools among our bourgeois politicians do not mock at us on this point any more. For even those politicians now see, if they would speak the truth, that international stock exchange capital was not only the chief instigating factor in bringing on the war, but that now, when the war is over, it turns the peace into a hell. The struggle against international finance capital and loan capital has become one of the most important points in the program on which the German nation has based its fight for economic freedom and independence. Regarding the objections raised by so-called practical people, the following answer must suffice. All apprehensions concerning the fearful economic consequences that would follow the abolition of the servitude that results from interest capital are ill-timed. For in the first place, the economic principles hitherto followed have proved quite fatal to the interests of the German people. The attitude adopted when the question of maintaining our national existence arose vividly recalls similar advice once given by experts. The Bavarian Medical College, for example, on the question of introducing railroads. The fears expressed by that august body of experts were not realized. Those who travelled in the coaches of the new steam horse did not suffer from vertigo. Those who looked on did not become ill, and the hoardings which had been erected to conceal the new invention were eventually taken down. Only those blinds which obscure the vision of the would-be experts have remained. And that will always be. In the second place, the following must be borne in mind. Any idea may be a source of danger if it be looked upon as an end in itself, when really it is only the means to an end. For me, and for all genuine National Socialists, there is only one doctrine, people and fatherland. What we have to fight for is the necessary security for the existence and increase of our race and people, the subsistence of its children, and the maintenance of our racial stock unmixed, the freedom and independence of the fatherland, so that our people may be enabled to fulfill the mission assigned to it by the Creator. All ideas and ideals, all teaching and all knowledge must serve these ends. It is from this standpoint that everything must be examined and turned to practical uses or else discarded. Thus, a theory can never become a mere dead dogma, since everything will have to serve the practical ends of everyday life. Thus, the judgment arrived at by Gottfried Feder determined me to make a fundamental study of a question with which I had hitherto not been very familiar. I began to study again, and thus it was that I first came to understand perfectly what was the substance and purpose of the life work of the Jew Karl Marx. His Capital became intelligible to me now for the first time, and in the light of it, I now exactly understood the fight of the Social Democrats against national economics, a fight which was to prepare the ground for the hegemony of a real international and stock exchange capital. In another direction also, this course of lectures had important consequences for me. One day, I put my name down as wishing to take part in the discussion. Another of the participants thought that he would break a lance for the Jews and entered into a lengthy defence of them. This aroused my opposition. An overwhelming number of those who attended the lecture supported my views. The consequence of it all was that a few days later I was assigned to a regiment then stationed at Munich and given a position there as instruction officer. At that time, the spirit of discipline was rather weak amongst those troops. It was still suffering from the after-effects of the period when the soldiers' councils were in control. Only gradually and carefully could a new spirit of military discipline and obedience be introduced in place of voluntary obedience, a term which had been used to express the ideal of military discipline under Kurt Eisner's higgledy-piggledy regime. The soldiers had to be taught to think and feel in a national and patriotic way. In these two directions lay my future line of action. I took up my work with the greatest delight and devotion. Here I was, presented with an opportunity of speaking before quite a large audience. I was now able to confirm what I had hitherto merely felt, namely, that I had a talent for public speaking. My voice had become so much better that I could be well understood, at least in all parts of the small hall where the soldiers assembled. No task could have been more pleasing to me than this one, for now, before being demobilized, I was in a position to render useful service to an institution which had been infinitely dear to my heart, namely, the Army. I am able to state that my talks were successful. During the course of my lectures, I have led back hundreds and even thousands of my fellow countrymen to their people and their fatherland. I nationalized these troops, and by so doing I helped to restore general discipline. Here again I made the acquaintance of several comrades whose thought ran along the same lines as my own, and who later became members of the first group out of which the new movement developed.
File 46.
Chapter 9. The German Workers' Party. One day, I received an order from my superiors to investigate the nature of an association which was apparently political. It called itself the German Labour Party, and was soon to hold a meeting at which Gottfried Feder would speak. I was ordered to attend this meeting and report on the situation. The spirit of curiosity in which the army authorities then regarded political parties can be very well understood. The revolution had granted the soldiers the right to take an active part in politics, and it was particularly those with the smallest experience who had availed themselves of this right. But not until the Centre and the Social Democratic parties were reluctantly forced to recognize that the sympathies of the soldiers had turned away from the revolutionary parties towards the national movement and the national reawakening, did they feel obliged to withdraw from the army the right to vote and to forbid it all political activity. The fact that the Centre and Marxism had adopted this policy was instructive, because if they had not thus curtail the rights of the citizen, as they described the political rights of the soldiers after the revolution, the government which had been established in November 1918 would have been overthrown within a few years, and the dishonour and disgrace of the nation would not have been further prolonged. At that time, the soldiers were on the point of taking the best way to rid the nation of the vampires and valets who served the cause of the Entente in the interior of the country. But the fact that the so-called national parties voted enthusiastically for the doctrinaire policy of the criminals who organized the revolution in November 1918 helped also to render the army ineffective as an instrument of national restoration, and thus showed once again where men might be led by the purely abstract notions accepted by these most gullible people. The minds of the bourgeois middle classes had become so fossilized that they sincerely believed the army could once again become what it had previously been, namely, a rampart of German valor, while the Centre Party and the Marxists intended only to extract the poisonous tooth of nationalism, without which an army must always remain just a police force, but can never be in the position of a military organization capable of fighting against the outside enemy. This truth was sufficiently proved by subsequent events? Or did our national politicians believe, after all, that the development of our army could be other than national? This belief might be possible and could be explained by the fact that during the war they were not soldiers, but merely talkers. In other words, they were parliamentarians, and as such they did not have the slightest idea of what was passing in the hearts of those men who remembered the greatness of their own past, and also remembered that they had once been the first soldiers in the world. I decided to attend the meeting of this party, which had hitherto been entirely unknown to me. When I arrived that evening, in the guest room of the former Sternecker Brewery, which has now become a place of historical significance for us, I found approximately 20 to 25 persons present, most of them belonging to the lower classes. The theme of Feder's lecture was already familiar to me, for I had heard it in the lecture course I have spoken of. Therefore I could concentrate my attention on studying the society itself. The impression it made upon me was neither good nor bad. I felt that here was just another one of these many new societies which were being formed at that time. In those days, everybody felt called upon to found a new party whenever he felt displeased with the course of events and had lost confidence in all the parties already existing. Thus it was that new associations sprouted up all round, to disappear just as quickly, without exercising any effect or making any noise whatever. Generally speaking, the founders of such associations did not have the slightest idea of what it means to bring together a number of people for the foundations of a party or a movement. Therefore, these associations disappeared because of their woeful lack of anything like an adequate grasp of the necessities of the situation. My opinion of the German Labour Party was not very different after I had listened to their proceedings for about 2 hours. I was glad when Feder finally came to a close. I had observed enough, and was just about to leave, when it was announced that anybody who wished was free to open a discussion. Thereupon I decided to remain. But the discussion seemed to proceed without anything of vital importance being mentioned, when suddenly a professor commenced to speak. He opened by throwing doubt on the accuracy of what Feder had said, and then, after Feder had replied very effectively, the professor suddenly took up his position on what he called the basis of facts. But before this, he recommended the young party most urgently to introduce the secession of Bavaria from Prussia as one of the leading proposals in its programme. In the most self-assured way, this man kept on insisting that German Austria would join Bavaria and that the peace would then function much better. He made other similarly extravagant statements. At this juncture, I felt bound to ask for permission to speak, and to tell the learned gentleman what I thought. The result was that the honourable gentleman who had last spoken slipped out of his place like a whipped cur, without uttering a sound. While I was speaking, the audience listened with an expression of surprise on their faces. When I was just about to say good night to the assembly and to leave, a man came after me quickly and introduced himself. I did not grasp the name correctly, but he placed a little book in my hand, which was obviously a political pamphlet, and asked me very earnestly to read it. I was quite pleased, because in this way I could come to know about this association without having to attend its tiresome meetings. Moreover, this man, who had the appearance of a workman, made a good impression on me. Thereupon I left the hall. At that time, I was living in one of the barracks of the 2nd Infantry Regiment. I had a little room which still bore the unmistakable traces of the Revolution. During the day, I was mostly out, at the quarters of Light Infantry No. 41, or else attending meetings or lectures held at some other branch of the army. I spent only the night at the quarters where I lodged. Since I usually woke up at about 5 o'clock every morning, I got into the habit of amusing myself with watching little mice which played around in my small room. I used to place a few pieces of hard bread or crust on the floor and watch the funny little beasts playing around and enjoying themselves with these delicacies. I had suffered so many privations in my own life that I well knew what hunger was, and could only too well picture to myself the pleasure these little creatures were experiencing. So, on the morning after the meeting I have mentioned, it happened that about 5 o'clock I lay fully awake in bed, watching the mice playing and vying with each other. As I was not able to go to sleep again, I suddenly remembered the pamphlet that one of the workers had given me at the meeting. It was a small pamphlet, of which this worker was the author. In his little book, he described how his mind had thrown off the shackles of the Marxist and trades union phraseology, and that he had come back to the nationalist ideals. This was the reason why he had entitled his little book, My Political Awakening. The pamphlet secured my attention for the moment, and I began to read, and I read it with interest to the end. The process here described was similar to that which I had experienced in my own case 10 years previously. Unconsciously, my own experiences began to stir again in my mind. During that day, my thoughts returned several times to what I had read, but I finally decided to give the matter no further attention. A week or so later, however, I received a postcard which informed me, to my astonishment, that I had been admitted into the German Labour Party. I was asked to answer this communication and to attend a meeting of the party committee on Wednesday next. This manner of getting members rather amazed me, and I did not know whether to be angry or laugh at it. Hitherto I had not any idea of entering a party already in existence, but wanted to found one of my own. Such an invitation as I now had received I looked upon as entirely out of the question for me. I was about to send a written reply when my curiosity got the better of me, and I decided to attend the gathering at the date assigned, so that I might expound my principles to these gentlemen in person.
File 47.
Wednesday came. The tavern in which the meeting was to take place was the Alter Rosenbad in the Herrenstrasse, into which apparently only an occasional guest wandered. This was not very surprising in the year 1919, when the bills of fare, even at the larger restaurants, were only very modest and scanty in their pretensions, and thus not very attractive to clients. But I had never before heard of this restaurant. I went through the badly lighted guest room, where not a single guest was to be seen, and searched for the door which led to the side room. And there I was face to face with the Congress. Under the dim light shed by a grimy gas lamp, I could see 4 young people sitting round a table, one of them the author of the pamphlet. He greeted me cordially, and welcomed me as a new member of the German Labour Party. I was somewhat taken aback on being informed that actually the national president of the party had not yet come, so I decided that I would keep back my own exposition for the time being. Finally, the president appeared. He was the man who had been chairman of the meeting held in the Sternecker brewery when Feder spoke. My curiosity was stimulated anew, and I sat waiting for what was going to happen. Now I got at least as far as learning the names of the gentlemen who had been parties to the whole affair. The Reich National President of the Association was a certain Herr Harrer, and the President for the Munich District was Anton Drexler. The minutes of the previous meeting were read out, and a vote of confidence in the secretary was passed. Then came the treasurer's report. The society possessed a total fund of 7 marks and 50 pfennigs, a sum corresponding to 7 shillings and 6 pence in English money at par. Whereupon the treasurer was assured that he had the confidence of the members. This was now inserted in the minutes. Then letters of reply, which had been written by the chairman, were read, first to a letter received from Kiel, then to one from Düsseldorf, and finally to one from Berlin. All three replies received the approval of all present. Then the incoming letters were read, one from Berlin, one from Düsseldorf, and one from Kiel. The reception of these letters seemed to cause great satisfaction. This increasing bulk of correspondence was taken as the best and most obvious sign of the growing importance of the German Labour Party. And then? Well, there followed a long discussion of the replies which would be given to these newly received letters. It was all very awful. This was the worst kind of parish pump clubbism. And was I supposed to become a member of such a club? The question of new members was then discussed. That is to say, the question of catching myself in the trap. I now began to ask questions, but I found that, apart from a few general principles, there was nothing. No program, no pamphlet, nothing at all in print, no card of membership, not even a party stamp. Nothing but obvious good faith and good intentions. I no longer felt inclined to laugh, for what else was all this but a typical sign of the most complete perplexity and deepest despair in regard to all political parties, their programmes and views and activities? The feeling which had induced these few young people to join in what seemed such a ridiculous enterprise was nothing but the call of the inner voice which told them, though more intuitively than consciously, that the whole party system, as it had hitherto existed, was not the kind of force that could restore the German nation or repair the damages that had been done to the German people by those who hitherto controlled the internal affairs of the nation. I quickly read through the list of principles that formed the platform of the party. These principles were stated on typewritten sheets. Here again I found evidence of the spirit of longing and searching, but no sign whatever of a knowledge of the conflict that had to be fought. I myself had experienced the feelings which inspired those people. It was the longing for a movement which should be more than a party, in the hitherto accepted meaning of that word. When I returned to my room in the barracks that evening, I had formed a definite opinion on this association, and I was facing the most difficult problem of my life. Should I join this party, or refuse? From the side of the intellect alone, every consideration urged me to refuse. But my feelings troubled me. The more I tried to prove to myself how senseless this club was, on the whole, the more did my feelings incline me to favour it. During the following days I was restless. I began to consider all the pros and cons. I had long ago decided to take an active part in politics. The fact that I could do so only through a new movement was quite clear to me. But I had hitherto lacked the impulse to take concrete action. I'm not one of those people who will begin something today and just give it up the next day for the sake of something new. That was the main reason which made it so difficult for me to decide in joining something newly founded. For this must become the real fulfilment of everything I dreamt, or else it had better not be started at all. I knew that such a decision should bind me for ever, and that there could be no turning back. For me, there could be no idle dallying, but only a cause to be championed ardently. I had already an instinctive feeling against people who took up everything, but never carried anything through to the end. I loathed these jacks of all trades, and considered the activities of such people to be worse than if they were to remain entirely quiescent. Fate herself now seemed to supply the finger-post that pointed out the way. I should never have entered one of the big parties already in existence, and shall explain my reasons for this later on. This ludicrous little formation, with its handful of members, seemed to have the unique advantage of not yet being fossilized into an organization, and still offered a chance for real personal activity on the part of the individual. Here it might still be possible to do some effective work, and as the movement was still small, one could all the easier give it the required shape. Here it was still possible to determine the character of the movement, the aims to be achieved, and the road to be taken, which would have been impossible in the case of the big parties already existing. The longer I reflected on the problem, the more my opinion developed that just such a small movement would best serve as an instrument to prepare the way for the national resurgence, but that this could never be done by the political parliamentary parties, which were too firmly attached to obsolete ideas, or had an interest in supporting the new regime. What had to be proclaimed here was a new Weltanschauung, and not a new election cry. It was, however, infinitely difficult to decide on putting the intention into practice. What were the qualifications which I could bring to the accomplishment of such a task? The fact that I was poor and without resources could, in my opinion, be the easiest to bear, but the fact that I was utterly unknown raised a more difficult problem. I was only one of the millions which chance allows to exist or cease to exist, whom even their next-door neighbours will not consent to know. Another difficulty arose from the fact that I had not gone through the regular school curriculum. The so-called intellectuals still look down with infinite superciliousness on anyone who has not been through the prescribed schools and allowed them to pump the necessary knowledge into him. The question of what a man can do is never asked, but rather, what has he learned? Educated people look upon any imbecile who is plastered with a number of academic certificates as superior to the ablest young fellow who lacks these precious documents. I could therefore easily imagine how this educated world would receive me, and I was wrong only in so far as I then believed men to be for the most part better than they proved to be in the cold light of reality. Because of their being as they are, the few exceptions stand out all the more conspicuously. I learned more and more to distinguish between those who will always be at school and those who will one day come to know something in reality. After 2 days of careful brooding and reflection, I became convinced that I must take the contemplated step. It was the most fateful decision of my life. No retreat was possible. Thus, I declared myself ready to accept the membership offered to me by the German Labour Party, and received a provisional certificate of membership. I was numbered 7.
File 48.
Chapter 10. Causes of the Cholera. The depth of a fall is always measured by the difference between the level of the original position from which a body has fallen and that in which it is now found. The same holds good for nations and states. The matter of greatest importance here is the height of the original level, or rather the greatest height that has been attained before the descent began. For only the profound decline or collapse of that which was capable of reaching extraordinary heights can make a striking impression on the eye of the beholder. The collapse of the Second Reich was all the more bewildering for those who could ponder over it and feel the effect of it in their hearts, because the Reich had fallen from a height which can hardly be imagined in these days of misery and humiliation. The Second Reich was founded in circumstances of such dazzling splendour that the whole nation had become entranced and exalted by it. Following an unparalleled series of victories, that empire was handed over as the guerdon of immortal heroism to the children and grandchildren of the heroes. Whether they were fully conscious of it does not matter. Anyhow, the Germans felt that this empire had not been brought into existence by a series of able political negotiations through parliamentary channels, but that it was different from political institutions founded elsewhere by reason of the nobler circumstances that had accompanied its establishment. When its foundations were laid, the accompanying music was not the chatter of parliamentary debates, but the thunder and boom of war along the battlefront that encircled Paris. It was thus that an act of statesmanship was accomplished, whereby the Germans, princes as well as people, established the future Reich and restored the symbol of the imperial crown. Bismarck's state was not founded on treason and assassination by deserters and shirkers, but by the regiments that had fought at the front. This unique birth and baptism of fire sufficed of themselves to surround the Second Empire with an aureole of historical splendour such as few of the older states could lay claim to. And what an ascension then began! A position of independence in regard to the outside world guaranteed the means of livelihood at home. The nation increased in numbers and in worldly wealth. The honour of the state, and therewith the honour of the people as a whole, were secured and protected by an army which was the most striking witness of the difference between this new Reich and the old German Confederation. But the downfall of the Second Empire and the German people has been so profound that they all seem to have been struck dumbfounded and rendered incapable of feeling the significance of this downfall or reflecting on it. It seems as if people were utterly unable to picture in their minds the heights to which the empire formerly attained. So visionary and unreal appears the greatness and splendour of those days in contrast to the misery of the present. Bearing this in mind, we can understand why and how people become so dazed when they try to look back to the sublime past that they forget to look for the symptoms of the great collapse, which must certainly have been present in some form or other. Naturally, this applies only to those for whom Germany was more than merely a place of abode and a source of livelihood. These are the only people who have been able to feel the present conditions as really catastrophic, whereas others have considered these conditions as the fulfilment of what they had looked forward to and hitherto silently wished. The symptoms of future collapse were definitely to be perceived in those earlier days, although very few made any attempt to draw a practical lesson from their significance. But this is now a greater necessity than it ever was before. For just as bodily ailments can be cured only when their origin has been diagnosed, so also political disease can be treated only when it has been diagnosed. It is obvious, of course, that the external symptoms of any disease can be more readily detected than its internal causes, for these symptoms strike the eye more easily. This is also the reason why so many people recognize only external effects and mistake them for causes. Indeed, they will sometimes try to deny the existence of such causes. And that is why the majority of people among us recognize the German collapse only in the prevailing economic distress and the results that have followed therefrom. Almost everyone has to carry his share of this burden, and that is why each one looks on the economic catastrophe as the cause of the present deplorable state of affairs. The broad masses of the people see little of the cultural, political, and moral background of this collapse. Many of them completely lack both the necessary feeling and powers of understanding for it. That the masses of the people should thus estimate the causes of Germany's downfall is quite understandable. But the fact that intelligent sections of the community regard the German collapse primarily as an economic catastrophe, and consequently think that a cure for it may be found in an economic solution, seems to me to be the reason why hitherto no improvement has been brought about. No improvement can be brought about until it be understood that economics play only a second or third role, while the main part is played by political, moral, and racial factors. Only when this is understood will it be possible to understand the causes of the present evil, and consequently to find the ways and means of remedying them. Therefore, the question of why Germany really collapsed is one of the most urgent significance, especially for a political movement which aims at overcoming this disaster. In scrutinizing the past with a view to discovering the causes of the German breakup, it is necessary to be careful lest we may be unduly impressed by external results that readily strike the eye, and thus ignore the less manifest causes of these results. The most facile, and therefore the most generally accepted, way of accounting for the present misfortune is to say that it is the result of a lost war, and that this is the real cause of the present misfortune. Probably there are many who honestly believe in this absurd explanation, but there are many more in whose mouths it is a deliberate and conscious falsehood. This applies to all those who are now feeding at the government troughs. For the prophets of the revolution again and again declared to the people that it would be immaterial to the great masses what the result of the war might be. On the contrary, they solemnly assured the public that it was high finance which was principally interested in a victorious outcome of this gigantic struggle among the nations, but that the German people and the German workers had no interest whatsoever in such an outcome. Indeed, the apostles of world conciliation habitually asserted that, far from any German downfall, the